All right, let's do just a quick Bible study real quick of, and in your mind, think of 1st, 2nd Samuel, 1st, 2nd Kings, 1st, 2nd Chronicles, kind of like the icing between the two Oreos. The middle of the cookie, okay? So let me show you real quick something that will help you, I think, rightly divide the scriptures. All right, let's look at Deuteronomy 17 for just a moment. Deuteronomy 17. And in this particular context, this is before Moses has died. And before the book of Joshua, before Joshua will be handed over the leadership to guide or to lead Israel into the promised land. In Deuteronomy 17, before Moses dies, notice verse 14. You had the prediction that they would ask for kings. Last Wednesday we showed 1 Samuel where they rejected God by asking a king, not Samuel. I want you to notice Deuteronomy 17 verses 14. Through the end of that chapter, you have a parameter or pericope, sometimes referred to as the guide that the kings would have to follow. And so, if you note verses 14 through verse 20, you will see the strict guidelines. Y'all see that? Okay. I'm not going to go into details, but I do want you to note that every king, in essence, will in some sense violate some of these principles. David may be, we might say, the one that doesn't, but I think with the wives and the multiplication of women, that certainly was a problem with his rulership. All right, so note that. Of course, then if you take your Bible and you continue to flip through the Bible or you turn pages, you'll get to the book of Joshua. Moses dies at the end of the book of Deuteronomy. We go into the book of Joshua and we don't have kings. We go into what's called the period of the conquest, where Joshua, at the end of the book of Joshua, they have subdued the land. God has fulfilled his promise by delivering them. There's still a battle to go on. They've got to finish eradicating Philistines and various pagan idolaters. But if you'll get to the 21st chapter of the book of Joshua real quick, verses 43 through the end of the chapter, verses 43 through 45, you'll note where those three passages indicate that God gave Israel all the land. Now, there's an important point to that. When God gives you something, you still have work to do. Okay? I think this is the parallel in New Testament Christianity. We take a person and they obey the gospel. When they are accountable, they understand by faith what to do, they respond to the invitation or the gospel, and they know they're lost in sin. How many sins does God wash away when they obey and respond to the gospel? All. Has God fulfilled his promise of redemption in that person's life? But is that the end or the beginning of their life? It's just the beginning. Does that make sense? So in many ways here, Joshua 21 verses 43 through 45 indicates God has fulfilled his promise. He got them to the land. In fact, verse 43 says, there failed not aught of any good thing which the Lord had spoken unto the house of Israel. All came to pass. Now you get to chapter 24, book of Joshua. This is Joshua's farewell speech. And you'll remember verse 14. You might even have this placard or this picture or this statement in your house mounted on a wall somewhere. And Joshua's farewell comments are, verse 14, therefore now fear the Lord, serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt, and serve ye the Lord, And if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land ye dwell. That's a key point there. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And the people answered and said, God forbid that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. And so, at this point, they've got no kings. They've not requested a king. They've had good, faithful men leading them. But in the midst of all of that, how many people were lost during Moses' leadership while they were in the wilderness? It's hard to quantify the exact number, but let's maybe ask it this way. Yeah. The first generation. How many years did they spend wandering basically in a circle in the wilderness before they even get to the promised land and Joshua leads them in? 40 years. Now, I think about those times and timelines as I get older more, because time seems to mean a little bit more to you, and you get it's a little bit more valuable, a little bit more precious. I was, this is kind of a silly sub-illustration, but I was cooking, grilling yesterday afternoon, and I set a hard 60-second timeline. I said, I need to turn or flip these. I'm not going to tell you what it was, because I don't want you to be jealous. I said, I got 60 seconds, but I need to go check a battery on a tractor real quick. And I started counting down in my mind, 1,001, 1,002, 1,003. And I got back in time. I was able to check the battery, see if it was working, get back to my grill, and I can guess how many seconds I had left. You'll never know, right? 15. I thought 45 seconds, you know, that's pretty good. I was able to accomplish it, and I was in my mind thinking, man, each one of those seconds was valuable. And then I was thinking about today, and I was thinking about my lesson, and I was thinking about 40 years and all these things. Time is precious. That's why Paul says to the Ephesians, redeem the time, for the days are evil. And I start thinking about, again, how little time we have, how fast it's going. But they spent 40 years wandering. God took 40 years. So look at your own life. How old are you now? Where are you at today? What are the lessons you've been learning? How has God been patient with you? Has he allowed you to wander? Has he allowed you to make choices and decisions that you wish you hadn't, but you learned some very valuable lessons from? Just an interesting lesson in time. And that's really what the Old Testament's all about. All right, get to the book of Judges real quick. And you have no king. And they're struggling for leadership. The tribe of Judah is going to be chosen as the leader. Verse 2 of chapter 1. The Lord said, Judah shall go up. I have delivered the land into his hand. And so they're going to have to continue the conquest and finish the fight. And God is... So the book of Judges is all about them not trusting God. No one taking leadership and synergizing, formulating, doing all things decently and in order, as 1 Corinthians 14:40 says that we're to do. Have you ever thought about the fact that God gave us his word, gave us his pattern, gave us his principles, eternal principles, and he then says, go do it. Go do it. That's the simplicity of the Great Commission. What's the simple command in Matthew 28? Go. How many people just don't go? They don't start. But as I get older, I realize how patient and how loving God is. Does he know when we start to go, when we will go? Does he know that we're going to make mistakes? Does he know that we're going to have regrets or think, I should have done that better? He absolutely knows, but he expects us to go. He also expects us to learn as we go. And that's a wonderful, wonderful lesson in life. But as we go, learn and stick to the book as best as you can. So that's the book of Judges, about 350 years. And we get to, they're doing everything in their own ways, pretty ugly period of time, sometimes called the dark ages of the period of the Bible. We get to 1 Samuel, and that brings us really to today. And by the way, the book of Ruth, this little book, four chapter book, what is this book all about? If I were to ask a broad question like that, what is this book all about?
I interpret it as God's acceptance of a non-Hebrew, non-Jew into his family, Ruth coming into the fold.
That's a good point. Matthew chapter 1, Ruth's certainly in there, Moabitish woman. But go a little bit further. You're right. What does the end of chapter 4 indicate? Which is then going to talk about who is David? A man after God's own heart. And what does David become in essence? The first example of a king.
He's the shepherd of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
He's the lion of Judah.
So remember last Wednesday I said something. When we look at the kings, I was saying I want us to be looking to who ultimately? The perfect king. I want to emphasize all the failures as best as I can. I want to show all the bad things. Because you ever thought about that in the sense of time? Again, talking about this essence of time. Why do we have the Old Testament? To show how much God hates us?
It's a Christ. It has a Christological thrust. It's all about Jesus. It's all about the one that you need is coming. You can't do it by yourself. I'm sending someone to do it for you.
Yep.
The whole essence of the law and the prophets and all of that was to drive Israel to their knees, to realize we can't be perfect. We need someone.
Yep. Perfect. Yep. Yes, sir, James.
One of the things that I love the most about Judges and Ruth is that throughout the book of Judges, you see the Israelites doing this thing on the other cycle of forgetting God, being punished, going back to Him in that circle. And you go to Ruth and you see a non-person that's not a part of the chosen race, and she chooses God, and everything works out for her in the end. Basically showing that God doesn't care if you're His chosen people. He doesn't care if you're not His chosen people. As long as you're choosing Him, as long as you're following Him, He's going to take care of you no matter what.
Very good. Yep. Yep. I mean, we've got to see it this way. And again, how long of a period of time, I didn't ask this last Wednesday, but if you were to generally summarize, how much time did they have to experience the kings? In history. Moses, about 1500 B.C., 1500 years before Christ. 1300s, period of the Judges.
The Southern Kingdom was about 300 years. The Northern Kingdom was about
200 years. You get the kings right around 1000 B.C., giving you kind of blocks of, you get Saul, David, and then Solomon, and then it's going to be 700, but when the Northern Kingdom is gone. We'll see that in this study. About 606 B.C. is when the southern kingdom, Judah, starts to, the Babylonians hit them, Nebuchadnezzar. And God said, you're going to go into captivity for 70 years to the prophet Jeremiah. And in 70 years, so you've got 350, 400 years of this period of kings that God allows to take place. It's really a short period of time if you think about it. Now, I think about things like this as you try to find principles, causal effects to apply to your life today. As I said, as we just pointed out, who's the king today? Who's perfect king? We don't need to be asking for kings. We've got one, right? Every government that stands or falls, secular government, will stand or fall because why? He allows them to stand, he allows them to fall. We'll learn that in the book of Daniel. We'll learn that in other principles. But secular rulers, are they allowed to exist? Romans 13, 1 Peter, various passages. Even Jesus, when Jesus said implicitly, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. He was not trying to destroy the Roman Empire, even though Daniel's prophecy said it would fall as a result of Christianity. That's another, we'll get to all that in time. But if they stand or fall, how long will they stand or fall? again, yeah, go ahead.
I do take into account that righteousness exalts a nation.
Good point.
The longer a nation really, and I'm not going to call us a Christian nation because that's not right. Okay, well, you're not a Christian nation. They are founded upon some Christian principles, but the longer a nation strives toward being a godlike nation and people, I'm wondering if God, and that, notice how I said wondering, I'm wondering if God allows that nation to continue to flourish. When they start going off, the time starts getting cut back on them.
That's right. So, let's make it personal. Let's make it the United States of America. This is real quick, just again, causal effects. We don't know how long, as a organized United States or nation, under our current constitutional system, we will be defined. If time stands, the Lord doesn't return, right? That's always the equalizer of all this. But Gina and I, she just finished that, have y'all into history? You like Alexander Hamilton? That big book, it was like a 40-something hour read, and she finally finished that yesterday. They've got a movie, a dramatization of that story because it's kind of the pop culture read of the day, I guess. Well, we went for our walk last night. She told me the story. She was telling me how, Brian, you really need to finish the last two chapters. I said, okay, I will. But we were talking about the Constitution. We were talking about all that these men, founders of the nation, and John Jay comes up, one of the early one of the first Supreme Court appointees, and he is on record saying that our Constitution, the rules and government, the frame of our government is wholly inadequate for a non-Christian. So, those being in the Federalist Papers and so forth, those were the ideas originally assumed. Royce just said, we're not a Christian nation. I agree. However, the framers of this Constitution, when they said the freedom of religion, let me ask you a question. When they were using the term freedom of religion, what were they not talking about?
Islam.
One.
Buddhism.
Two.
Yeah.
Hinduism. We got Hindu temples around the country. I noticed yesterday there was a argument posted, I'm trying to think where that was, of a brand new Hindu cultural facility and temple that was set up and established here in the country. There's multiple. They're all over the place. Texas has got a bunch of them. But you're right. Those ideologies would be very kindred with the paganisms and the various ancient forms of idolatry that we defeated through Christ. So it is true, in one sense, that then our Constitution, though, was framed upon principles with the Bible in mind. With the Bible in mind. And that's documented in the Federalist Papers. But however, yes, you're right. If you live in the state of Minnesota, the likelihood of a Muslim representing you is very, very, as a political figure, congressman, is a high impact. In Michigan, the same way. Dearborn, Michigan is a... So that was not the case. What established this history, this country in the 1700s and back to the 1600s, what was the Exodus all about in reality? What were people fleeing from when they came out of Europe?
When Europe, Catholicism.
Okay. Breaks from Catholicism, which were being broke out. So again, now I'm going to bring you back to, and they said freedom of religion in our Constitution. Now, I said, what did they not mean? But what did they mean? They were going to allow the various sects that were landing in this country under the guise of Christianity, but they were called sects or denominations, divisions. That's what they're talking about, the freedom of religion. In other words, the Anabaptists can exist and must exist peacefully without killing each other with the Episcopalians, Church of England, King Henry VIII and his division. The Methodist, the Presbyterians, Calvinism, they said those sects must be allowed to exist. Now, I'm giving you again a small history lesson. In 1830, we start really getting hammered by men like Alexander Campbell, Barton W. Stone, Walter Scott, and various other individuals that are going back to the scripture saying, speak where the Bible speaks, be silent where the Bible is silent, and then you can get it right. Okay, and we call that the Restoration era in this country. But then in the 1830s, we started to see Joseph Smith. Does his name ring a bell? He comes up with an entirely fabricated story called the Book of Mormon today about the Lamanites and these lost tribes of the Jews who must be in this country that have to be converted back to the Reformed gospel. And that was his theory on how to do it. And by the way, we need to, for a while, be allowed to have multiple wives. Did Mormonism in the 1830s fit the Constitution in the mindset of the general public? No, it didn't. It was killed. I mean, that's why they ran them out and they chastised them and they got on the Oregon Trail and other places historically and ran because this country said that is a cult, that's not biblical. So, things change. Cultures change. As our responsibility here is, and we talk about this a lot as the elders of this congregation, I'm not trying to reset the country. I can't do that. If I can do a good job being a lighthouse of truth, preaching the gospel, helping you see causal effects, what is the primary responsibility or arena of responsibility that Royce, Ryan, Mike, and myself have here at 9th and Main? Right here. And what you do with it from here, go out. We hope that you impact culture. We hope that you bring people back. Yes, sir.
The ripple effect of a drop in the water starts here.
That's right. The ripple effect. I love it. Yep. And that's what we're trying to do. That's our best responsibility. I noticed Royce, as soon as Trump's administrator, you got your name in the hat to run for president, right? It's not my primarily goal or desire to run for political office, okay? I would tell you that I believe the most, if a man will understand his responsibility, the most important job biblically for a human being to aspire is an elder in the church. There's nothing higher than that in the Bible. As far as God, the way he looks at responsibility and authority, is anything more responsible and anything more important to God than the church in the Bible? Look at Ephesians 3:21. And I need to get back on topic, or we'll never... This is where Roy said, I'll have to keep up with you as the backup teacher. Look at Ephesians 3:21. If someone has that, please read that.
To him be glory in the church by Christ Jesus to all generations forever and ever. Amen.
So, church right here. I tell Mike, we talk to the elders, there's nothing higher than the locally autonomous Church of Christ. Body of people. And we're talking about people, right? Church is people. Saved people. That's why I want you to know how important you are. It's not about money. People come all the time wanting money. Well, we assess whether or not money will be the actual solution to anything. What really helps people is what?
The Word.
The Word. Enlightenment of truth. Give people the tools to make the best decisions they possibly can. All right, so sandwiching that illustration there. Okay, these texts are, again, all in the middle of what's going to happen before we get to Christ. I want to show you 1 Chronicles 10 just for a moment. 1 Chronicles 10 is a different layout. Than 1 2 Kings. It's more focused upon David and the southern kingdom, and that'll make more sense to you once we get there. You're not going to be able to read that, probably. 1 2 Chronicles has a priestly focus because of something. It skips Saul, really, gets to 1 Chronicles 10 after a bunch of genealogical impacts here. And then it's going to have an emphasis upon David's kingdom and the preparation of the temple. So I want you to notice here again, 1 Chronicles 10, look at the last two verses. You get really one chapter, a snippet of Saul and his life. King Saul, first king that's selected there in 1 Samuel. And what does 1 Chronicles 10 verses 13 and 14 say? Anybody?
Saul, go ahead.
Whoever, yeah, go ahead, Marcus.
Saul died for his unfaithfulness, which he had committed against the Lord, because he did not keep the word of the Lord, and also because he consulted a medium for guidance. But he did not inquire of the Lord, therefore he killed him and turned the kingdom over to David, so did he.
Yep. So we'll see how that plays out. Now, with all that said, I want you to fast forward to the book of Hebrews just for a moment. Hebrews chapter 11. And though this will be kind of an ugly period of time, I want you to see chapter 11. This is referred to as the heroes of faith. It goes back and picks out characters in the Old Testament, starting with Abel in verse 4, and it'll go down through Enoch in the genealogy of Adam. It'll go down to Noah, Abraham, get to Isaac and his children. But I want you to notice something here that will stand out, and I think this is important to see as we're studying through this. Notice verse 13, there's a summary statement here where it says, all these Old Testament patrons died in a certain way. And what is the way that they died in the Old Testament? Yeah. Now that's an interesting statement in verse 13. According to faith, which, can a man be saved without faith today? Look at verse 6 in this chapter. This applied to the Old Testament individuals. What does Hebrews 11 verse 6 say?
But without faith it is impossible to please him. He that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him.
Okay, so all the Old Testament patrons fall under the same principle. They had to have faith, right kind of faith. Faith is not without obedience, we know that. So then, verse 13 again. What were they looking for, though? In verse 13, there was something they needed to look for. And something they confessed as well. The promises. Which again is a pointing towards Christ. Remember in the Sermon on the Mount? I noticed Chris Stovall and all schools have to now, secular schools, have to post the Ten Commandments. And Chris Stovall was implementing and quoting back what's referred to as the Lord's Prayer in Matthew chapter 6. But in that prayer, Danielle got into a good study with her friends about the kingdom, thy kingdom come. Now, at the point when Jesus is teaching his apostles or disciples how to pray, and he says, pray in this manner, our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come. Has the kingdom come?
Yes.
Okay.
It is still coming.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. Hebrews 12, 28, 29. That's right here. And yet it was established. The kingdom is upon us. It's fulfilled. Who's the king now? Yeah. We have a kingdom. We have a king. We have all authority being given unto him in heaven and upon earth. And so, interesting, Danielle kind of, well, by the way, we think it's good to implement the principles back into schools. Back in the 60s, if you were in public schools in the 60s in this country, in this state alone, I have the two manuals, Old and New Testament surveys. What were you being taught in schools in the state of Texas? You remember, Mom? The Bible. A summary of the Bible. They had an Old Testament survey or summary and a New Testament survey that was taught in the schools. Now, we're not doing that. That's not been implemented.
As I recall, day, we all did the Pledge of Allegiance every morning, and then there was a prayer with the men.
Yeah. So they're doing a lot of that more, and I'm not opposed to it, but again, this is a cultural thing. Going back to our comments, in a secular world, how do you influence for good? Well, I know what I'm doing as a Christian. I know what I'm doing. So I need you to just think in terms that are broader somewhat. Make sure we understand the specifics. All right, back to Hebrews chapter 11. I want you to see this passage. Notice verse 16 of chapter 11. What did they desire?
And how they desire better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them.
Okay. All right. Now, notice. Get to verse 24, Moses. He refused to be called the Pharaoh's daughter, and he chose something. What did he choose in verse 25?
To suffer the reproach of Christ.
Mm-hmm. So if we suffer today, and our suffering is in the day of judgment, a lot of people suffer today, but they suffer because of, I'm going to say it, stupidity. But when we have the suffering of Christ in our mind, who of you as a Christian are not going to suffer if you're a Christian? What did Paul tell Timothy? Yea, and all that live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer. You are going to suffer for righteousness. If you're trying to avoid it, then you're in the wrong line of work. And I would tell you that even a billionaire, millionaire, whatever, they suffer too. 1 Timothy chapter 6 says that the reproaches of riches. Talks about riches bringing upon much suffering. I assure you, you will suffer. So the question is, what will you suffer for? What will be your motive or your purpose? Hebrews chapter 11. This shows us example and motive. Why did Moses suffer? Enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, or to, again, obey God and look forward to the promises, the Christ. All right, now drop down after you'll see the Jericho walls in verse 39 tumbling down. And that's going to go to the period of time of Joshua, verse 30. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they were compassed about 7 days. Rahab, verse 31, getting closer to the kings. And here we are, verse 32. You get a mention of which king shows up in verse 32. Which king doesn't show up? Saul doesn't show up. And notice the statement there. And Samuel and of the prophets, he says in verse 32, what more can I say about these men? These individuals. And then it says in verse 33, their life. What does verse 33 basically summarize till you get to Christ? Look at verse 38. Tell me about the value that they possessed in the world. And yet they lived and wandered around. Does David do that some? Does David find himself in caves? Does he find himself hiding from Saul? Sometimes hiding from his own family. And then look at what it says in verse 39. What kind of report did they receive? That God was watching them during this long period of time. We think of it as a long period of time. And they without us, what does verse 40 teach? Today, that's us. Complete or perfect is the idea. We need to see these people as family. In eternity, those that are of faith will be our eternal family. That's who we'll spend eternity with. Not Saul. All right, chapter 12, I want to make one last statement here. You get to verse 22. He's making comparisons between Old and New Testaments. You'll see the change in verse 21 where he says, the sight of Mount Sinai and the revelation of the law of Moses and the mountain being on fire. Remember, they were told, the Israelites, at the foot of the mountain, what were they not to touch? Don't touch that mountain. And God, again, is demonstrated. But then look at what he says in verse 22. What today have we come into? All right. Now, what did he say they were all looking for in the Old Testament days, chapter 11? They were strangers. They were pilgrims. And they were looking for a better, a heavenly. And what does the Hebrews writer tell us we have received? We've come into it. Now, I'm going to ask you a question here, just to be very fundamental, basic. Who has come into this kingdom today? How do you get into it? It's so fundamental.
Well, all those ones that were pre-cross were by faith. All the ones after the cross were the blood of Christ. Well, I guess they're all the blood of Christ.
That's right. There's one statement, though, about today, He that believeth and is baptized shall be. Know ye not that so many of you as were baptized into Christ? And it's a sad but amazing thing to me that people will take and throw that away. Say, it doesn't matter. Oh, it does matter. It does matter. Baptism, New Testament. You have to understand it. We're not talking about baptizing babies, are we? We're talking about by faith, understanding what we're doing here. Come into this thing. And again, it has to do with faith. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. And he refers to the church as the general assembly, church of the firstborn, verse 23. It's recorded and written in heaven. That's why, do the elders of the church here add you to the church? Who does the adding and the subtracting? All right, Jesus, God. All right, look at verse 28 now, last two passages of this chapter. And this is where we need to have our mind focused to make the Old Testament study really good. What does verse 28 and 29 say, please? Someone read that.
Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us have grace by which we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. For our God is a consuming fire.
Thank you. All right, back up to John chapter 18 for just a moment. And I'm going to go right back and do a quick summary with the slides. Look at John 18, Jesus at the cross. And what does Jesus say in John 18, verse 36? Verse 35, if you want to see the context of Pontius Pilate, a sectarian, secular, Roman official, not a Jew. What does Pontius Pilate? Someone read verses 35 through 37, please.
Pilate answered, am I a Jew, your own nation, and the chief priest that delivered you to me? What have you done? Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight, so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from here. Pilate therefore said to him, are you a king then? Jesus answered, you say rightly that I am a king. For this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice.
Thank you. All right, Mark chapter 1 real quick. Notice the words. And look, now this is at the beginning of Jesus' earthly ministry. This is before the cross, three years before that John 18 passage Victor just wrote. Now look right at the initiation of his message. What does Jesus, what did he come to do? Mark 1, 14 and 15. Thank you. look at Mark chapter 9, verse 1, just to see what Jesus said. He's talking about the cross, and he says, some are not going to taste death. What will some experience and see fulfilled in the life, in the time of the Christ? Mark chapter 9, verse 1.
Assuredly I say to you that there are some standing here who will not taste death till they see the kingdom of God present with power.
All right. Again, did that or did that not happen? And we read in Hebrews that it did happen. It happened at the day of Pentecost. Look at Hebrews 2, verse 9. Now, last Wednesday, I referred to this passage, and I'm going to go right back to it. What did Jesus do that no one else could? Hebrews 2, verse 9 and verse 10.
Well, we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, should taste death for every man. For it became him who, for all things, and by whom all things, bring many sons to glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect for their sufferings.
Thank you. All right, so all of this will be fulfilled. Book of 1 Samuel. This is your basic outline, breakdown, and then we'll take a break. Chapters 1 through 7, the birth and rise of Samuel. You've got Hannah, of course, a sweet story. We're not going to all this. Don't have time for this quarter. Samuel will serve Eli. Eli's sons are corrupt. It's this, all this, that builds to, again, the frustration in the nation to get us to the kings in chapter 8. The ark will be captured. God will defeat it with Dagon. Chapters 4 through 7, there's a victory at Mizpah. But again, God raises a faithful prophet as the last judge. That's Samuel. That's why the books are called 1 and 2 Samuel. Chapters 8 through 12, Israel demands a king. We saw that last Wednesday. Israel rejects God's kingship. Saul's chosen. He's anointed, confirmed. Saul's or Samuel's farewell speech, and he's basically telling them, your days are numbered, y'all are in bad shape. And again, the people are seeking a human king over God's rule. That's the first 8 through 12, first 12 chapters. Chapters 13 through 15, Saul's reign and decline. He offers unauthorized sacrifice through impatience. You see his son Jonathan, his faith, and his relationship with David in time. Saul's very rash. He doesn't allow his soldiers to eat. Jonathan comes in and, you know, lets them eat. Saul spares Amalek, and he wasn't allowed to. Saul's rejected. The theme here, again, partial obedience equals what? Disobedience. Rise of David. David's anointed king. What kind of a person is David? How old is he? He's young. He's out tending to his father's sheep, learning. What was Moses doing for 40 years when he fled Egypt with his father-in-law, Jethro? Yeah, he's a shepherd. It's interesting. All right, David's anointed. David defeats Goliath. David's jealous, or Saul's jealousy. Tremendous story and lesson on jealousy, bitterness. How many of you suffer with that? Don't. Get over it. Hebrews chapter 12, the bitterness of Esau is brought to play again. Bitterness, the root of bitterness destroys you. Don't envy. Be thankful for what you have and you'll do good. All right, so there's that. And then, thank you, Luke. David is on the run. Why is David on the run? Because Saul's going to try to kill him multiple. How many times could David kill Saul? Yeah, he had the chance. He cuts off a piece of his garment to basically say, buddy, I could have killed you. But he didn't. And so David trusts God's timing. That's another lesson in this 1 Samuel book. Saul falls into ruin. And we talked about these various themes, key passages Wednesday. Won't go back over all that. We'll end and we will get to. Royce, I did it. We're going to do lesson one Wednesday night in our book. So I'll try to have you some information Wednesday printed. To go over it with the class. It should be very basic, but yet we'll bring out principles as we continue to study. I appreciate your time and attention very much, always.